Up next, one of our favorites, William Henry, back with us. He's got many things to talk about. He'll be traveling. He's got another new show coming out in the fall on Gaia. We'll talk about that, too, and so many things. Plus, next hour, we'll take your calls with the investigative mythologist, William Henry, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with our friend William Henry, author, investigative mythologist, futurist. William's been writing about human transformation and merging with technology since 2002. He is a noted author, spiritual advisor, presenter on the hit History Channel program Ancient Aliens. He's a presenter of several Gaia programs, a new one coming out in the fall. He'll talk about that. This incredible series called Ascension Keepers. And along with his wife, Claire, he leads very incredible spiritual adventures to Egypt, England. He's got one coming up to Spain, Israel, Lourdes. He's got it all. We're going to have some fun tonight with William Henry back on Coast to Coast. Mr. Henry, how are you?
Wonderful, George. It's so good to hear your voice.
You too, my friend. Tell us about the new Gaia show that comes out in the fall.
Well, it's called Ascension Keepers. And what it is a timeline of this concept of human transformation and ascension. I've gone back into the ancient past and found that we had some ancient encounters with otherworldly extraterrestrial beings who have come for various purposes, among which is advancing us in our spiritual evolution or ascension.
Exciting. That'll be fun. People can watch that when they sign up at Gaia. And go to Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com. William does a great job, as so many other people, on that incredible network. Then there's a little show there called Beyond Belief, William, that we do a little bit of.
And I'm looking forward to coming back and talking with you on Beyond Belief, too, George.
Yeah, that's going to be happening. Absolutely. Now, you're going back to Egypt sometime in March of next year. I remember when you were there during the Arab Spring uprising, and you were on a bus. You remember that day?
I sure do. That was quite a harrowing experience.
I think I had to let you know that something was happening in Cairo.
Well, that, and also you gave us a tremendous sense of hope and a lifeline. I mean, we had been quarantined in our hotel for a few days under curfew. We didn't even know if we were going to get our flights once we made it to the airport. I mean, gosh, there were like 20,000 people trying to get on six flights, as it turned out, when we arrived. But on the way, we had gone through all these neighborhoods where there were literally kind of local militias that were protecting their turf from all these various incredible gang activities that erupted during the Arab Spring. And your phone call just gave us a sense that, hey, we're going to make it. We're going to be just fine.
We wanted to get you back, and Claire and everybody else, and you did it. You came back.
I sure did.
I think that's when they tossed out Mubarak, right?
That's exactly what happened. The Egyptian people had said, hey, we've been hearing all about this coming prosperity. There's billions of dollars that were being offered to Egypt from countries around the world to assist the Egyptian people, and it was all going into the pockets of Mubarak. And they finally said, we've had enough, and that was the Arab Spring.
Let's talk a little bit about your Egypt trip and some of the things you've been doing in Egypt. What is the Genesis Tube, by the way? What is that?
Well, that was a really fun experience I had. You know, I've been to Egypt 22 times now.
You know, my dad was born there, God rest his soul. He was born in Cairo.
I didn't know that.
They were coming from the Middle East, and they stopped off in Cairo, and out he came.
Hey, fantastic. Well, there's always an Egyptian connection.
Yeah, and they stayed 6 years.
Wow, yeah. Wonderful. Wow, it sounds like the Holy Family sojourn. They did something very similar, too.
Exactly, exactly. But
so the Genesis Tube comes from research I've been doing at the Temple of Hathor at Dendera. Many people are familiar with Eric von Däniken and his work, where he went into the crypt there at Dendera, and he saw this incredible relief on the wall, and said, that looks like a lamp or a light bulb. And indeed, this relief actually does, and I have photos of it in my article on williamhenry.net in this article that we're talking about called The Genesis Tube. And so that became a real sort of step up in terms of starting to look at ancient Egyptian reliefs with the idea that they encode some form of ancient technology, possibly even extraterrestrial technology. So they start looking at the tube. They say, hey, yeah, it clearly resembles a lamp. And then It took another step forward when some physicists and engineers looked at it and said, actually, it not only resembles an incandescent light bulb, but also resembles a cathode ray tube. And that, of course, is the basis for television and your computer screen and all that kind of technology. And it started to take people into the idea that maybe this scene actually encodes some kind of plasma physics. Because that's what the Crookes tube or cathode ray tube ultimately opened up. So I happen to be at the temple. I'm with my group. We're getting ready to go down into the crypt, and here comes one of these temple minders. And these guys are such incredible gentlemen. They are mostly in their 80s. They've been in these temples for decades. They know them inside and out. And fortunately, having been there so many times, they know me now too. And so occasionally they'll take me off into a part of the temple to show me something new, or we'll just have a chat. Well, this time we're getting ready, as I say, to go into the crypt, and this gentleman's waving his arms at me, and he's kind of upset, and he's saying, "It's not a lamp. It's not a lamp." And I'm like, "Okay, well, maybe you've been watching Ancient Aliens, or you know me from, you know, yeah, whatever, from being in Egypt so many times." And he says, "It's not a lamp." And I'm like, "Okay, it's not a lamp. So what is it?" And he says, "It portrays the moment of creation." I'm thinking the moment of creation.
Like the Big Bang?
Like, that's exactly what I'm thinking, George. Like the Big Bang? And so I step into one of the side chapels that happens to have one of the color representations of this tube, and I Google moment of creation, Big Bang. And up comes a whole series of images done by various science pages and authors depicting the Big Bang, this moment, this flash of light. The Bible says, "Let there be light," and that's one of the premises of the Big Bang, is that there was this moment when everything was condensed into this tiny, 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 inconceivably tiny dot, and exploded into light. And over 13, 14 billion years, the galaxies began to evolve, and here we are now, at the very end of creation. And what they show is this sort of tube-like effect. I mean, they're not saying our creation is encased within a tube, but the images that they use to portray the Big Bang are virtually identical to what we see in the tube at Dendera.
Interesting.
And I'm thinking, wow, that's a new layer to this. No one has ever really stepped out and said that the Egyptians knew about that moment of creation. But then when we go back into the Egyptian text, they do refer to the time of shortly after creation. They call it the Zeptepi, and this is a very important time when creation was starting to come together to the Egyptians. And so it's possible that what we are looking at here is the Egyptian depiction of how everything came into being. And so it was kind of funny, George, because I came back with that image, and so I asked the gentleman, the temple minder, I said, "Okay, if this tube portrays the moment of creation, who is this giant being that is holding that tube?" And he just kind of smiled at me, shook his head, and walked away.
I love that. You know, it's hard enough to try to figure out how the Egyptians or whomever built the pyramids at Giza, and now we have this to contend with.
Well, exactly, and this is the thing that's so exciting. I have been very fortunate over the years to take a large number of engineers and physics types on my tours, and they're like kids in the candy store when they get around some of these reliefs, because they know instantly upon looking at them that they're looking at blueprints for advanced technology, or what could be blueprints for advanced technology. Because, of course, Egyptologists will say there's no inscription that accompanies this tube at Dendera that says that this is some kind of advanced technology like a Crookes tube or a plasma tube or anything like that. So we're using our own lens through which to view this symbolism, but it's really incredible how easy it is for those who know to easily identify the technology that's just kind of present on the temple walls and in the museums. We happen to be in the Cairo Museum with a group, and we have a gentleman who has a PhD in engineering. He's a tool and die maker. He's from Detroit, and he works on spacecraft parts. That's what he builds to very, very precise levels. And we're standing in the museum, and there's this famous artifact called the schist disk. It looks like a wheel. It's a completely out-of-place artifact. It looks like nothing else you see anywhere in ancient Egypt. And this gentleman takes one look at that and says, wow, I build things like that. That's like a vortex generator. And so he said if he could get a high-resolution scan of that schist disk, that he could tell us exactly how it was made and its ultimate purpose. And that's something we're working on now, is trying to get access to the schist disk to make a high-resolution image of it for him.
That's dramatic. Now, you just came back from Italy shooting for Ancient Aliens. Tell me about that trip.
Oh, that was incredible. There's a little-known area in northwestern Italy near Turin and Milan called Valcamonica. And this is an area where you have the oldest petroglyphs in the world. These are artwork etched into the stone there. There's over 150,000 images that are etched in the stone that go back to the Neolithic era. And we went there to investigate the spacemen that were etched into the rock. And they were absolutely mind-blowing, George. They clearly were depicting beings with radiant helmets on, holding some kind of objects in their hands. There's actually two of these depictions at Valcamonica, and it was absolutely astounding to me just to come face to face with these ancient images that portray clearly to us space beings.
Did they look like they're in a helmet with the space outfit on, or
just the
helmet?
No, they were looking like they were they had helmets that appeared to be radiating light. They appeared to be floating. The images perfectly matched what you would see if someone were out floating in space, the way their body was positioned. And it just suggests to me that there must have been a moment of contact in ancient Italy, that the artist who was portraying this must have seen what he etched on the rock. And there's a couple of images nearby that resemble spaceships. There's a nine-legged dog. And you look at the story like a cartoon, thinking some kind of extraterrestrial being, a space being, came down, brought his nine-legged dog with him, and hung out for a while.
And these depictions are 5,000-plus years old?
Yes, exactly.
My gosh.
And that's acknowledged by the historian. I interviewed a couple of historians, local historians, who were talking about it, and they don't know exactly what they mean. They're still looking for the Rosetta Stone for these images, but Valcamonica has all kinds of stories throughout the ages of lights in the sky and strange occurrences. It's very near a place called Mount Musinae, which is kind of the center of UFO activity in northern Italy. And the local historians actually think this is the place where Constantine had his famous encounter with the blazing cross in the sky. Normally, it's thought that this took place outside of Rome near the Milvian Bridge. But other historians there say, no, it actually took place here in Mount Musinae. And what's fascinating about this, George, is that this whole valley, you're entering into what's now called the Susa Valley. And not only do they have these incredible stories of UFO sightings and encounters throughout the ages, but they also tell of this lost city of Rama that existed in this valley as well. And we went to investigate that, and indeed we found some really astounding cyclopean remains of what appears to be a city.
Doesn't this city tie into Atlantis sometimes?
It does.
It comes up.
Yeah, that's what the local legend says, is that the people of Rama were Atlanteans who had settled Rama originally as a colony, but then after the cataclysm of Atlantis, they resettled in northern Italy. And so then you have layer after layer then of legends building on the Atlantis myth and this idea of advanced technology. They tell the story of at Mount Musinae of how Phaeton, the son of the Greek god Helios, crashed his golden chariot into the mountain and left this technology for the locals to uncover, including a golden wheel that was guarded by his golden robotic assistant. And you read these stories and you're thinking, this is absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, it clearly tells of contact in the ancient world. It's like it's the Italian version of Roswell. And these very alluring legends tell how inside Mount Musinae, you could still find examples of this technology and this golden robotic assistant, and that this is, in fact, becomes the origins of the secrets of alchemy in northern Italy, that wealthy families in that area, especially in Turin nearby, knew the secrets of how to make the Philosopher's Stone and how to turn lead into gold, and that it all originally came from Fatante in this alleged ancient contact with extraterrestrials in the ancient world.
Do you think, William, that if Mars was inhabited, whatever the calamity was that killed that planet, that they may have fled and they came to planet Earth?
You know, I really do believe that, George. I mean, I've been looking at that story for quite a long time, and they're just like we have an allure or a tug for gold. We've also got a similar allure and tug to return to Mars. And I say intentionally return to Mars because I do believe that. I think that Mars, clearly we're now getting evidence, was once a living planet. And we have a strong, strong belief that Mars is going to be the place where we can ultimately advance the human race, that we'll make a backup copy of ourselves and go live on Mars. And just the other day, Elon Musk said he plans on retiring on Mars. So there's always been in the ancient astronaut theory this running stream of thought that says, yeah, we originally came from Mars, that something devastating happened on Mars long ago, and that ultimately we'll return and be able to remake Mars into a habitable planet.
What is so bizarre, I think, the Arabic word for Mars is Cairo.
It's Cairo, I know.
I mean, that is just bizarre.
It really is, and I talk about this in my talks. That one of my favorite photos is the panoramic view of the Giza Plateau. There's a place that they often take groups, and it's a beautiful overlook where you can see the expanse of the plateau, and there's nothing around the pyramids. And when you look at that, you could think, "Gosh, I could be on Mars. This could be any planet." And you get this very strong sense that this Giza Plateau is indeed connected with pyramid structures on other planets in our solar system. And Mars definitely comes to mind, and it just feels like you're on a Martian surface when you're standing there at the Giza Plateau.
William has several books out, including Cloak of the Illuminati, Oracle of the Illuminati, his website, williamhenry.net. Well, you've had that website a long time, haven't you?
I have. You know, going on 20 years now. It's hard to believe.
That's fantastic. Good for you. We're going to take calls next hour with William, and also when we come back after the break, we're going to talk about some current things he's working on, including artificial intelligence and what is happening with consciousness and change. This is a changing planet, isn't it, William?
Rapidly and accelerating.
It's accelerating to the point where, is it out of control, or can we handle it?
Well, I think we're going to have to we need to have a vision of where we can potentially go with all of this, because that's going to make the pain that's on the way a whole lot easier to endure. And we need that leadership to step in to say, okay, this is the direction humanity is going. And if we continue on this path, that we have two possibilities here. We're either going to go to a point of complete destruction and collapse, or we're going to be able to direct this chaos and all this creativity into our ascension as a species and the transformation of humanity into a space-faring, space-migrating civilization.
Let's talk about end times prophecy when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, William Henry with us again. We'll take calls with William next hour. William, your thoughts on end times? I, you know, keep hearing so many stories that, you know, the battle between good and evil continues. Where's your stand on that?
Well, I'm certainly of the opinion that we are in a form of the end times. We're in an echo or a reflection of it, most certainly. And I believe that because one of the key aspects of the end time scenario in Christianity is this idea of the ascension of the species, of a transformation of our bodies into light, so that then we match the resurrected Jesus in a new perfect world that begins to emerge in the aftermath of that. And this is exactly ultimately what Silicon Valley and our artificial intelligence groups have in mind, is the perfection of our body, of the leaving behind or transformation of our physical bodies into digital bodies, mm-hmm. that inhabit a simulated reality made of ones and zeros, effectively made of light. And so what we're trying to do is to ultimately take control of human destiny and human evolution and create an entirely new civilization in the digital realm, a new universe, in effect.
With what's happening, does it match end times in the Bible?
Well, it does, because obviously, you know, the one that so many of us talk about is the mark of the beast, that is one of the key end time prophecies, that you won't be able to buy, sell, or trade unless you've got the mark of the beast. And that is certainly coming online now with the advent of technology and chip technology that's now becoming more and more more accepted, unfortunately.
They said because of cell phones that younger children are beginning to develop horns on their heads. They came out yesterday that they seriously are beginning to see little horns growing on kids, and they think it's because of the way they're talking on their cell phones all the time. The bones are beginning to change. Isn't that that's bizarre?
It is bizarre, and we are clearly merging with technology, and people like Elon Musk, in fact, believe that we have to merge with artificial intelligence in order to survive. But people don't realize that this is a ring pass knot, that once we fully embrace this technology, Homo sapien will be gone forever. I mean, I tell people that we are in the same relative position as Neanderthal was at the end of the last ice age, when the Neanderthal man was well suited to life in Germany when there was very cold weather. They had short, stocky bodies, a short nose, and were very good at surviving in those conditions. But as the ice age ended and things began and climate change started to take effect back then, they weren't well suited to that change. They couldn't adapt, but Homo sapien could. And we're now in a position here where we are experiencing climate change, where we are experiencing a change in the human body, an assault on the body via technology. And Homo sapien, unless it begins to adapt to this new environment, will simply not survive, and Homo sapiens will cease to exist within a couple of generations, because a new version of humanity is already on the stage, and that is a version of human being that is merged with the machine, and we call those transhumans, or H+, or H2.0, humanity 2.0.
Will they have emotion?
Well, this is something that's very concerning, because as this technology continues to rise and dramatically rise, it seems that our suffering is also skyrocketing too. I mean, despite numerous technological advances, you would think that we would be directing our culture towards a greater degree of prosperity and happiness. That's not what's happening. People are becoming more and more controlled by governments and by corporations, and they're losing their sense of freedom, their individuality. These corporations and governments are trying to define how all of us think, how we live our lives, and that means that we're turning ourselves effectively into robots. And in fact, they're clearing the way now for a robotic invasion of our civilization, where within the next 4 to 5 years, we'll literally see billions of robots begin to emerge on the planet, and humans are becoming more like machines rather than the machines becoming more like humans.
Matt Drudge had a picture on his website today of what the future of a human being will look like through this evolution process, and it's a hideous-looking creature.
Yeah, it really is, and this is, you know, from our perspective, it is definitely hideous-looking. I saw that, George, with the hunchback.
Yeah, yeah.
Double eyelids, and, you know, I agree with you that from our perception, that seems to be a de-evolution, and that is very concerning. And this is something we're all going to have to start getting more and more used to, is that humans are not going to look like what we typically think a human being looking like. With the augmentation of the human body and our ability now to change our form coming online, we're going to see all kinds of new versions of humanity. And I always defer to what Pope Francis says about this, is that we can't put limits on God's creativity, that maybe this is how we are to evolve. And I hold out of a scale of 1 to 10, I think that that's, you know, I put that at less than a 1, really. I mean, I'm just kind of hedging my bet that thinking, I don't think this is how we're meant to evolve. I don't think that we're meant to become machines and lose our individuality, lose our emotional component, lose contact with our soul. I mean, what's the point of an existence like that? I don't think God intended us to be that way, but I also hold open to the possibility that perhaps this is a phase that we're entering into, because this will lead to ultimately us reclaiming our true sense of humanity.
What do you mean by convergence of three currents, William?
Well, there are three major currents that are developing in our world right now that I'm keeping an eye on. One is the singularity, which is what is presently unfolding in artificial intelligence and in technology centers, where we're racing towards creating machines that are smarter than we are, maybe by a little bit, maybe by a lot, and creating a superhumanly intelligent being and a global brain that we're all going to be wired up to. The second current is what I call the skingularity, which is what we were just talking about, which is the merging of our flesh with artificial intelligence technology, of augmenting our brains with nanotechnology and other technologies that give us super intelligence by once again linking us to the cloud or this global brain. And then the third current is coming from Christian prophecy of the idea of ascension or the rapture, when some of us will choose to leave the planet, either through a spiritual ascension or by an ascension into simulated realities. And this is what many parents talk to me about these days, that their kids are playing these simulated reality games in their schools and in classrooms, and they're being encouraged to create online avatars or digital versions of themselves, and are being encouraged to think that maybe life in a simulated reality is going to be better than life in this physical reality that we're presently inhabiting. That's a reflection of the Christian idea of ascension or rapture.
And is that a possibility of why so many young children seem to be just in another world?
Yes, exactly, because they are being taught that they are literally creators of this other world, and that they can soon make a choice to literally step into and live in this artificial world.
Now, if civilization collapses, as some scientists believe, up to 30 years, maybe even sooner, that picture we saw in Drudge, how realistic do you think that could be?
Well, I think we could be, again, facing the situation that, like Neanderthal faced, where there's this sudden dramatic climate change and you see one version of humanity simply disappear en masse suddenly and apparently, or feeling like it spontaneously, and a new version emerge that is better adapted to life in this environment. An example of this is the introduction now of 5G, the super fast connection that we're
some say starting. That's dangerous. I had a guest right before you came on who thinks it's going to be very dangerous to us.
Well, exactly. You have governments, you have medical people with peer-reviewed articles saying 5G is lethal to the human body. It's lethal to all living things. But yet you have the similar governments or other governments and corporations who are racing as fast as they can to introduce 5G so they can roll out all of these brain-computer interfaces and this advanced technology, autonomous cars, and all this sort of thing. And the way I look at it is that while 5G is lethal to the human being, it's quote-unquote the air for the next human being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the plan.
Interesting.
And so here we have this situation where we're advocating what we're going to we're facing a climate change crisis. This is what we're told, and I believe a lot of that's true, or certainly some of it is true. What is the answer to the climate change crisis? Oh, what we have to do is build smart cities that are better able to use our resources. Well, what is a smart city? Oh, a smart city is a city that's driven by 5G, that has total surveillance technology, where everything is interactive, where every street light, every piece of technology is reporting back to some corporation, and we're all being monitored so that we don't use more resources than we need to. Well, the problem with that is that 5G is lethal to all living things on this planet. And even Elon Musk is now planning on launching 20,000 satellites to totally irradiate every single point on this planet. And so, on the one sense, they're saying AI, 5G is the answer to climate change, But the answer that they're proposing is lethal to every living thing on the planet. It doesn't make sense unless there is some kind of plan from maybe some elite organization or group to eliminate masses of people and introduce a new version of humanity, a transhuman that's capable of living in this poisoned environment.
William, do you think artificial intelligence is going too far?
I think we're on the verge of it going too far. We no longer talk about the ethics of AI and how we can slow this down and utilizing it or begin utilizing it. There's no leadership coming from the spiritual side, from your major religious organizations. It's the corporations that are now running the show, and they've got their foot on the gas, trying to go as fast as they can to accelerate the implementation of AI, rather than to slow down and say, wait a minute, maybe we're in a runaway situation here, which we are.
I mean, some of it's good. I happen to like the smart traffic lights, which if you're there at night and you're the only one there, the traffic light is smart enough to say, let this guy go, and they change the lights, automatically. I think that's pretty good.
Well, there are wonderful benefits to AI. There's no question about that. And I'm certainly not one to say, hey, we need to just eliminate it altogether. But the problem is when it gets into overdriven control, where we have corporations especially that are telling us what to think, when to think it, and that if you are not towing the line, the corporate line, we're in a 1984 George Orwell scenario already. I mean, we have far surpassed anything that Orwell predicted would happen in our time in terms of the rise of totalitarian states using this technology to control and manipulate it, or to control and manipulate. And it's not just governments. It's actually corporations like Facebook and Google that are, in fact, more powerful than governments. They operate completely without any kind of regulation. There's no oversight. And they're far more dangerous than any government on the planet right now.
When we come back a little bit later on, I want to talk more about Lourdes and what's going on there. You're going to plan a visit there, aren't you, sometime next year?
No, we're going in September of this year.
Oh, are you? This year?
Yeah, love to have everybody join us. Lourdes is one of the most phenomenal places I've ever been in the world and can't wait to return.
That's where the Virgin Mary supposedly visited a little girl named Bernadette, and now people swim in that region and get healthy.
Yes, they do. I mean, it's one of the great miracles of the Virgin Mary, that she appeared to Bernadette, this young peasant girl in southern France. This is in the Pyrenees region of southern France, down south of Toulouse. She appeared to Bernadette over 17 times and finally gave her the message that she was to help her, that the Virgin was there to help her to open up a spring of healing water. And this was in the 1850s, and now here we are 150 years later, and millions of people go to Lourdes every year to enjoy these healing waters and to connect with the energies and the waters that are absolutely phenomenal.
What was happening during that era, William, where so many people saw the apparition of the Virgin Mary? Fatima, Lourdes, she was all over the place.
Yeah, in fact, for the past 2,000 years, there have been some astounding sightings of these apparitions of the Virgin Mary, where she was the first Christian to ascend. She was the first Christian to attain her light body. And by that I mean she had dissolved her physical body into light and now could re-manifest or reappear as a being of light. And this is what Bernadette saw. There's hundreds of these sightings throughout, especially southern France, where they're very open to these kinds of ideas. And then Our Lady of Guadalupe, of course, is another famous apparition of the Virgin Mary. And in all of these instances, you have not only a sighting of the Virgin Mary in her light body form, but then the creation of a healing center or a healing spring where people can now come and receive those energies or healing vibrations from the land, where she has literally infused the land with these frequencies that are palpable. You feel them when you're there, and ultimately you can utilize them for healing physical as well as spiritual and mental maladies. It's absolutely phenomenal.
You don't think Bernadette was making up the story, do you?
No, I don't, because in her story, first of all, Bernadette didn't know who she was talking with. She just said, the white thing appeared to me again. The white thing appeared to me. She didn't know it was the Virgin Mary. And it was only when the Virgin Mary identified herself as the Immaculate Conception that the local priest began to pay attention, because here's this little 12-year-old girl who's talking about a very high concept Catholic doctrine that had only been implemented 4 or 5 years before, the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. And so that got everybody's attention, and they started to take her seriously.
If nobody's seen the 1943 film, The Song of Bernadette, it's that old little black and white film, they've got to see that movie.
Yeah, they've got to see that.
It's
and then
a classic.
Also, you can go online and you can search the apparition of the Virgin Mary in Cairo in 1965, when around 400,000 people saw the Virgin Mary appear over a church in Cairo, and several people took photos of it. And the photos are really quite remarkable.
We're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls with William Henry. These are just a few of the things we've been talking about. You jump on board with us, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.